Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
I can hear my eyeballs move. Holy cow. Crazy.
That's right. This woman could hear her eyeballs move. And that was only one of many unbearable symptoms. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
Why are you asking me this battery of questions?
30 more seconds. I'm almost done. About 2 minutes more of drilling.
Because we don't know where you've come, and we don't know where you're going to go after this.
You know, it just sort of adds like a level of stress to something that's already stressful.
When we're looking for the needle in the haystack, the
just get there. Just don't die.
If you can see my face, I know it's radio.
And every time I see that, I think, that didn't exist before. We made that
Watch the heck. People will want to wait for my radio because...
On today's show, our senses are our windows to the world, to experience sights, sounds, flavors, everything around us. So what happens when wires get unexpectedly crossed or clipped and you lose something that has been crucial to your day-to-day functioning? Our stories today will explore that and offer some insight into how our senses function. We're going to start out with a story produced by reporter Todd Bookman. He pitched this idea to us during one of our editorial meetings. It's one woman's story. She experienced some really crazy symptoms, and all of us were sitting around the table going, "Wait, what?" Take a listen. I'm sure you'll understand.
Back in the spring of 2006, Pam Gilbert was having a typical weekend at her home in suburban Virginia.
It was a Sunday afternoon. I was out doing some yard work with my husband. Some neighbors stopped by. We were talking, and I felt like somebody was pulling me to the right, like they had a rope tied around my shoulders and were pulling me. And I just felt a little off balance. And I asked them if I was leaning, and we, you know, they asked me, you know, had I been drinking? And we just all just thought it was funny because I was leaning to the right.
Pam, who is in her mid-40s at the time, doesn't think too much of it, but the symptoms don't let up.
And within a couple of days, I wasn't able to walk. I had severe vertigo. I was vomiting. And it got so bad that my husband took me to the emergency room.
Had you ever experienced anything like this before?
Never had a dizzy spell. It was just so out of the ordinary, we didn't know what was going on.
At the ER, the doctors don't spot anything out of the ordinary. They diagnose Pam with an ear infection and send her home. But a few more weeks pass, and the dizziness is still there.
I could not drive a car. I wouldn't have been able to pass a sobriety test. I was just really unsteady. Felt like I was in a fun house, but not so fun.
The days go by, and soon Pam figures out a way to treat herself. She simply stops moving her head. Like she won't turn it from side to side to look at something. Instead, she rotates her whole body.
And so I was moving much like a robot would.
And that robot movement, though a bit bizarre, pretty much settles everything down. The vertigo subsides, and she's able to get back to her regular life. Pam has 2 kids, she's involved with Girl Scouts and the Neighborhood Association. Whatever this spell was, it seems to have passed, as long as she keeps her head locked in position. But as time passes, Pam notices something strange starting to happen with her ears. Her hearing becomes extremely acute, extremely sensitive. She starts picking up all these sounds she had never noticed before.
One day, I was upstairs in my bedroom. We live in a 2-story house, and we have a basement. And I looked at my husband, and I said, as some wives will do, "Honey, the faucet in the bathroom is dripping. Can you go turn it off?" And since his side of the bed is closer to the bathroom, he assumed I meant the sink in our bathroom. But what I could hear was it was the sink in the basement had a dripping faucet, and I asked him to go turn it off, and he was like, "You can't possibly hear that." And sure enough, he went downstairs, and it was dripping.
It was as if Pam had suddenly developed this superpower.
It's kind of like, you know, how birds and bees can see different colors because they just have that ability. I could hear sounds that other people couldn't hear.
All these normally muted noises of daily life start catching her attention.
I could hear when the kids would roll over in bed, even though they were two doors away. My door was closed and their door was closed.
She could hear every mouse scurrying through the wall.
If there was a leaf on the roof, I heard it.
Pam's hearing begins to take over her life. These noises start dominating her consciousness.
And then I noticed the sounds began to hurt. And it became a psychological fear of sound because I could hear everything.
The telephone became unusable because holding the handset up to her ear was like having a megaphone blasted 2 inches from your head. She couldn't go inside her kid's school because teenager screams and the echoes off the linoleum were like daggers. So she decided to go back to the doctors.
I was seeing all the ear specialists and I went to a neurologist who, you know, told me, I hate to say this, but he said, you're just a bored housewife looking for attention. Here's a handful of pills.
Pam knew there was something more serious going on. During the next few months, the external sounds she heard so clearly were joined by internal sounds, by noises coming from inside her own body.
I had this booming heartbeat in my ears. I had this tinnitus, this ringing in the ears, a constant note, just like a blaring horn in my head. Those sounds were unshakable. There wasn't any way to turn them down. They never went away. I could hear the bones in my neck cracking, you know, just kind of like sandpaper. At one point, I could hear my eyes move.
Yes, you heard that correctly, her eyeballs. When Pam reads a book, the tinnitus in her ears starts correlating with her eye movement across the page.
So it would be squealing till I got to the end of the line. And when I moved my eyes to the beginning of the next line, it was a different kind of squeal. Just as painful, just as loud, just a different note. There were days where I thought, my brain was going to be vibrated into oatmeal. There were just times where you just couldn't think straight because of the noise going on internally.
I asked Pam if she could describe the sounds in her head, what it was like to live with this.
Yeah.
She asked me to follow her to the garage. We hop into the Honda.
So this is what it's like. You ready? That's what it's like 24/7. There's no volume control, and there's no way to turn it off.
Ricky Martin, car speakers, top volume. This is not a good way to go through life. Like a bullet to your brain. Upside, inside out. Living the vida loca. By this point, Pam is basically living as a hermit. She's avoiding all public settings, turning down dinner invitations, and not going on Girl Scout trips. She also begins to develop a system of signs to communicate with her husband and kids, who know there is something going on, obviously, but don't fully understand the extent to which she's suffering.
When I was in the depths of, I'm going crazy, and this isn't anything that talk therapy is going to help with, there's not a pill I can take, I'm the bad kind of crazy. I can hear things that other people can't. So I'm really deeply disturbed, and I have to hide this from everyone.
At this point, the only moments of relief came in the evening, when she would put on talk radio.
So I would turn on NPR. All Things Considered was music to my ears because it was
All Things Considered.
So
and I'm Rob Uchi.
Beautifully matched to the sounds going on in my head. It would mask all those sounds, and I was able to sleep. So I don't know if you'll want to put this on the radio, but I used NPR to fall asleep.
You know, a lot of people find public radio boring enough to put you to sleep.
It's not boring. It was just this tone that was calming and soothing, and it wasn't syncopated. It was very... it was smooth.
We are definitely going to replay this story during our next pledge drive. But anyways, in 2008, so 2 years into this disorder, Pam finds herself back at the doctor's office, but not for her hearing issue.
I don't know. Maybe I had a sore throat or something. And I went to see my family doctor, and he just took me by my arms. And this is the family doctor. And he held me and he got up in my face and said, there's something very, very wrong with you. And we have to find out what it is because these medications may hide the next symptom that leads to your diagnosis.
He sends her to get more tests at yet another ear, nose, and throat doctor who takes a look at her and says,
wow, you got some really strange symptoms. I've never even seen any of this before, but I'm going to send you to Johns Hopkins. These guys are really good, and they'll be able to figure out what's wrong with you.
I'm Lloyd Miner, and I'm Dean of Medicine at Stanford University.
And you spent some time in Baltimore, right, at Johns Hopkins?
I did. I spent 19 years at Johns Hopkins.
Miner is also an ear, nose, and throat doctor, but his specialty is the inner ear and the balance system, also called the vestibular system.
Our inner ear, our vestibular system, is like our gyroscope. It tells our brain how our head is moving, and we use it all the time. It's our inner ear, it's our balance vestibular system that enables us to drive a car along a bumpy road. Because when you're driving a car or when you're running, your head's bouncing up and down, but you don't have any trouble looking at road signs, at other things in front of you. And the reason you don't is that for every head movement, that head movement's being detected by your inner ear, and your eyes are moving in a way that compensates for the head movement.
So this balance system is at the heart of how we move through the world, how our senses, like sight and hearing, work together to feed the brain information about spatially where we are. Dr. Miner is an expert in this relationship. And in the spring of 1995, a patient comes in with a vestibular system problem.
And I saw a gentleman in his mid-50s who came in with kind of a bizarre complaint. He said that when he sang in the shower, he saw things moving. And he was very specific about the way in which they moved. And he said, you know, they're moving as if they're moving about a clock face.
The shampoo bottle, the loofah, they almost rotate when he starts singing.
And in fact, he said, look, I can show you if you just, you know, give me something where I can put a loud noise in my my right ear. I can show you because when I'm looking, you know, at myself in loud noises, I see my eyes move.
So Miner gets a piece of equipment, makes a tone in the patient's right ear, and he sees the guy's eyes jump.
They weren't random eye movements. They were very tightly timed and linked to the sound, and they were always in the same direction.
And this fact that they jumped the same way each time turned out to be a huge clue for Miner. Our vestibular system is composed of three tiny little fluid-filled canals. They're so small, all three of them would fit on top of a dime, and they're tucked inside the inner ear. Miner suspected that the canals must somehow be involved with the way this guy's eyes were moving, and he had this suspicion because of, well, pigeons.
Pigeons became involved because the way people over a century ago discovered that the inner ear had a role in control of eye movements and in balance A lot of those original studies were done in pigeons.
Researchers, including an Italian biologist named Pietro Tullio, would, I don't know, strap down these birds and remove the bone over one of the canals.
And then they would push on the membranous portion of the canal, the fluid-filled portion of the canal, and they would observe that the pigeon's eyes, and oftentimes its head, moved in the plane of that canal.
Just like his patient, the guy who sings in the shower, the eyes of the pigeon would jolt the same way.
And therefore, it seemed to me there had to be a similar problem in these patients. Somehow, the bone was likely to be missing over that top balance canal.
Miner had made the discovery. He figured out that this tiny layer of bone, for whatever reason, isn't there in patients with this condition, which he dubs superior semicircular canal dehiscence, dehiscence being the word for rupture or opening. And because there is now this opening, sound waves, which usually travel through the middle ear and then into the inner ear without disrupting these canals, instead, the waves now kind of rumble right through them.
The balance canal, the top balance canal, becomes a sound receptor.
It's almost like an escape route. This sound energy is supposed to be moving from A to B, and then it just leaks.
That's right. Supposed to be moving from A to B, but then all of a sudden C opens up. And now it can move from A to B, and it can move from A to C.
That's what explains why these patients have heightened sensitivity to external sounds, and also the noises inside the body, like the muscles that move our eyeballs. It's like this seal that's supposed to be in place to protect us from these noises has a hole torn through it.
We can think of the vestibular system ordinarily as being a black box that we never have to think about. It's always there. It's doing its job. And then when there's this opening, or when there's another problem with the way the vestibular system works, then all of a sudden, you know, everything falls apart.
I just remember Dr. Miner saying you had this condition, and us just looking at each other like, holy cow, I'm not crazy.
Just knowing there was something physically wrong was a huge relief to Pam Gilbert and her husband. It meant the problem was in her head, but it wasn't in her head. Dr. Miner explained the treatment he helped pioneer, how he could go in through her skull, lift up her brain, and get access to the bone protecting her canal, where he could then plug up this 2-millimeter hole.
We leave Johns Hopkins, we come home, and I'm like, did he say brain surgery?
It is a serious surgery. There's the chance hearing in her right ear could be permanently lost. There's a small chance for facial paralysis. And like every time you open up the skull, something unexpected could happen. But Pam wasn't going to be the first to get the surgery. And overall, it's considered a good option for people with severe symptoms. Pam, though, doesn't see it this way. She's just not thinking logically anymore.
My ability at that point to take in complex information, process it, make a thoughtful, reasoned surgical decision is just ludicrous. I'm an animal at this point. I can't tie my shoes and have a conversation at the same time. So I find out I need the surgery, and in my mind, I've converted that to a death sentence.
She's totally exhausted, totally worn down after years of this cacophony in her head. And rather than opt for the surgery, she makes a deal with herself, a deal she now realizes was totally irrational.
I think, well, my daughter's in high school now. I can live like this for 4 more years, and then I'll just be gone. It was magical thinking, delusional thinking. I would just disappear. Never said the word suicide, but I was just going to be gone. Because once my kids were through high school, I will have done my duty. And I would just be gone.
And then September of her daughter's freshman year arrives, and Pam notices a new symptom, something called autophony.
So autophony is this symptom where you can hear your own voice. And, well, everyone can hear their own voice. But with this, you hear your voice as loud as you can think of like a rock concert. That's what your voice becomes. Only it's a rock concert of fingernails on a chalkboard.
Speaking in anything above a whisper is like a stick of dynamite going off in her head.
Certain letters make certain vibrations. I couldn't say the letter M. Too much vibration.
When your name is Pam and you lose the letter M, you are in bad shape. Living, being awake, existing in this world had become a total nightmare.
It just sounds so silly. It just sounds so silly. But it's torture. Superior canal dehiscence syndrome is torture. There's just no pretty way to make a cute analogy. It makes you want to kill yourself in the end. And if you don't get diagnosed, that's what some people do.
So on March 4th, 2011, Pam goes in for surgery. This procedure, she's convinced, will kill her.
And I went, asked the anesthesiologist to give me something for nerves, because I'm having brain surgery. And I kissed my husband goodbye, and I thought that was it. But I couldn't do any more. I said goodbye. So, imagine my surprise when I wake up from surgery. I'm awake, and the world is peaceful. It's the whole new world. It's a whole new world. And it doesn't hurt to just lay there. And I knew it worked. I said the letter M. Said it quietly. I don't know that anybody heard me. But it was just the letter M. It wasn't this vibration machine that turning my brain to mush. It was just another letter. It was amazing.
This story was produced by Todd Bookman and mixed by Charlie Kyer. Special thanks to Pam Gilbert, of course, and also to Dr. John Carey at Johns Hopkins Medicine for his help with this story. Saga of crazy, debilitating symptoms that all traced back to a tiny defect in her inner ear made me think about the art and science of diagnosing patients. In Pam's case, it was a really, really rare condition that went undiagnosed for two torturous years. But more often than not, patients and their physicians are dealing with something far more pedestrian. So when that one doctor suggested that Pam was a bored housewife losing her mind, that feels like an insensitive thing to say, but on some level, it was a more likely diagnosis than superior semicircular canal dehiscence. Physicians often use an interesting analogy to talk about the balance between common and rare possibilities.
As a medical student from day one, you are taught that if you hear hoofbeats, that you should think horses because horses are far more common than zebras. You're taught not to think instantly of zebras.
This is Paul Offit. He heads the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Working there changes the horse-to-zebra ratio significantly. His patients have usually already been seen by other physicians. A lot of them have something serious going on. So in his life, zebras are common.
So when we, for example, see someone with a sore throat, we'll think about an unusual disorder called Lemierre's disease, which is a thrombophlebitis, which is to say an infection of a vein in the neck that ultimately causes a bacteria to invade the lung. And it's a very unusual disease, and we see it, frankly, all the time.
I asked Ovid how he proceeds in making a diagnosis, balancing common causes, rare diseases, all of the different options before him.
You have to keep tearing it down to what are the hard findings that you have. You know that X is true. You know that Y is true. Given that, how do you put that together? You keep working from there. It's there. There'll be an answer there. Just have to keep working.
And what's your equivalent of me going online and Googling my symptoms? So if you're stuck and you have a case and you need to get to the next level, where do you go? Do you reach out to your colleagues? Do you have a network?
Our equivalent of Googling online is Googling online, which is what we do. We actually just go. In fact, Google is a great resource to do this. You just look for case reports that are similar to see whether or not this has been reported before.
Do colleagues reach out to each other?
All the time. And so there are experts in, for example, tuberculosis or experts in fungal disease or experts in vaccines. So whenever we have an issue, they can often help us.
Is it a little bit like being a detective sometimes?
It's often like being a detective, and that's the fun part of it. It's more fun when you actually figure it out, but, you know, it's a little less fun when it takes you too long to figure it out. You know, you have this set of signs and symptoms, and you're trying, and you come up with what you think it is. This is what you think it is. And so you sort of move forward with those tests, and then you see whether or not you're right.
I'm thinking nowadays patients probably are asking for more tests because they have perhaps heard of tests or we are learning more online. How is that affecting medicine in what you see and what you hear from your colleagues?
My sense is people don't have to ask for more tests. We seem to be perfectly willing to do a lot of diagnostic procedures and tests, arguably too much so. I mean, you could argue that in a better system, you would formulate a differential diagnosis from what you think is most likely to what is least likely and then start with most likely and work your way down. What we tend to do is just include all of those diagnoses in our initial round of tests because we don't want to miss anything for any length of time. That's a far more expensive way to do things.
But how do you do that most likely and least likely when there's always a chance that it is the least likely and then you miss something? So how do you learn that balance?
Again, you go with what are the signs and symptoms of that patient, rating them in the following way. The most important thing is the history that the person gives you. The second most important thing is the physical exam. And the least important thing generally are the laboratory tests.
And I guess living with those decisions is something that as a physician you just have to learn when the decision was not the right one.
Right. I think the most difficult part about being a doctor, frankly, is the fact that, one, we don't know everything. Two, there's always some level of uncertainty. I mean, you know, there's layers that protect you. I mean, the intern has seen the patient. The senior resident has seen the patient. The fellow in infectious disease has seen the patient. You've seen the patient. So there's a lot of layers there, and you do testing to try and figure this out. But the fact of the matter is there's always uncertainty in what you do, and you always know to some extent that you may be missing something. And that's difficult. It's difficult to live with uncertainty, not just for the doctor, but also obviously for the patient. You'd like to think that we're all bones from Star Trek, you know, where you can just have that magic machine that scans up and down and says, this is what you have. It just doesn't work that way.
Paul, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Paul Offit heads the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Our show today is about our senses, and our next topic is touch. How do we feel? I don't mean this as in I'm tired, I'm exhausted, I'm full of energy, but as in the millions of brain processes that relay tactile information. Neuroscientist David Linden explains all of this in his new book, Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind, and he joins us now. David, thank you so much for being on The Pulse.
Thanks for having me.
How do we process touch on the most basic level?
Well, I think the most important thing to realize about touch is that we feel it as a single unified sensation. But in truth, it's many different separate sensations blended into one. It's heat and cold and pain and caress and sexual sensation and texture and pressure and fine form. There are separate sensors for all of these things in the skin, and all that information comes together to get blended in the brain.
And then we have to assign meaning to it yet.
We do, and I think the crucial thing there is that if you were to follow this touch information into the brain, you would find that there are two basic processing stations. One of them is just there for the facts about touch. Where in my body am I being touched? And then the other part is a more emotional and contextual center where expectation and personal history come into play. And this is what makes, for example, a caress on the arm from your sweetheart in a loving, connected time feel good. But if you get that very same caress on your arm with the same location and pressure and what have you in the middle of an argument with your sweetheart, it won't feel the same way at all.
What happens to us when there is a lack of touch?
Well, during early childhood, if you don't receive loving touch when you are a newborn and a toddler, then it's an utter disaster. And we know this recently from the experience of orphans in grossly understaffed locations in Romania in the 1980s and 1990s. There was nobody to care for these kids, and they were just lying there untouched. And what we know is that these children develop cognitive impairments, they're depressed, they have problems forming bonds with people, and they don't just have psychiatric and learning problems, they also have problems with their bodies. Their immune systems don't develop properly, their digestive system doesn't develop properly, they're stunted in growth, and even a little bit of touch, even if a volunteer comes in and does 30 minutes a day of loving touch, it completely ameliorates all these problems. So unlike sight and hearing, both of which you can completely lose from the beginning of your life and have a completely rich and fulfilling life, if you don't get loving touch early in your life, there'll be a disaster.
What do we know about the mechanism there? Why is that so devastating?
In truth, we don't understand the mechanisms. In other words, I would love to be able to tell you, well, there's this pathway of neurons and these chemicals involved that go from loving touch to, say, development of the immune system. But that's still a mystery.
How does social touch, like a friendly slap on the back or a hand on the arm or the shoulder, how does that affect our mood, our perhaps performance in the workplace?
Well, social touch is glue. It's what binds sexual partners into lasting couples. It's what brings families together. It's what makes teams in the workplace and literally sports teams. There was a great study that was done by Dr. Keltner's group at UC Berkeley where they looked at teams in the NBA and they watched all the games in a particular season and scored all the high fives and chest bumps and pats on the rear end. And then they asked the question, does that celebratory touch predict anything about what happens in the second half of the season? And what they found is that the teams that had more celebratory touch both won more games in the second half of the season and played in a less individualistic fashion, more like a cooperative group.
What have we learned about the line between touch and pain?
Well, what we know is that pain, as we experience it, has two parts. Just the facts of pain, what we call the discriminative aspects that are processed in one part of the brain called the somatosensory cortex, and then the emotional component, which for pain is negative. And so if you have damage to the part of your brain that processes the emotional pain signals, and I were to whack you on the thumb with a hammer, instead of going, oh no, ow, that hurts, that's terrible, the way someone would normally, you'd say, yep, that's pain. Yeah, it's bad. Now it's throbbing. But it would have no emotional resonance for you at all. It would be emotionally neutral.
And can we learn anything from that part of science, perhaps in terms of how to help people with chronic pain?
Well, we can learn a lot, because what we know is that the emotional component of pain can be changed by circumstance enormously. So if you're a soldier and you're in the middle of battle and you get shot or you take shrapnel, you might not even notice that pain in that moment, because the contextual signals in your brain are overriding the pain signals. We can harness what's happening to the soldier in the heat of battle, we can harness ourselves. So people who suffer from chronic pain can benefit from mindfulness strategies and meditation and self-soothing and stress reduction in order to get a handle on their pain without drugs.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me on. It was fun.
David Linden is a neuroscientist. His new book is Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. This is The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott, and we're exploring our senses today. I remember a while ago I talked to two scientists who research smell, and they said that sometimes it feels like smell is the stepchild among the senses, the sense we're most likely to take for granted. But when we can't smell, we miss out on so much information. Let's listen back to this story Carolyn Beeler produced for us a few years ago. She spent a day with a Philadelphia woman living without smell.
For most people, Reading Terminal Market is a smorgasbord of scents. Frying cheesesteaks, fish,
salmon, bronzino, and bluefish,
and freshly ground coffee. But for Andy Hockman, all of it, even the lilac and eucalyptus at the flower stall, smells the same.
I smell nothing, air, the same smell I would smell in front of the coffee place, in front of a tray of freshly baked chocolate chip cookies, the same neutral, blank, indescribable nothing.
Hockman is a freelance writer and teacher who lives in Mount Airy. She lost her sense of smell about 6 years ago while on a family vacation in Mexico.
I was surrounded by all kinds of smells, like the little store that sold Mexican vanilla and coffee. I couldn't smell any of it.
The winter before, Hockman had had a series of bad colds and likely a sinus infection. Later, she was diagnosed with nasal polyps, inflammations in the nasal cavity. Her sense of smell came back for a few weeks 2 years ago when a doctor put her on oral steroids.
What was amazing about that was that each thing I could smell came trailing a whole storehouse of memories that were connected with it. So I smelled these pizzas in the back of my car, and I remembered being in college working at the newspaper and having a stack of really greasy pizzas delivered every night at 9.
But the drugs were only a temporary fix. When she stopped taking them, she quickly lost her sense of smell once again.
Many, many times during a typical week, someone, even the people in my family who've known that I've had no sense of smell for years, will say, "Oh, smell this," or "That smells so good," or "I don't think this yogurt is good anymore. Here, give it a smell." And I can't. That was a surprise to me, how much we talk about and refer to smell as a common or even a unifying experience.
Because the sense of taste is really so much about smell, the self-described foodie says she now tastes in black and white instead of Technicolor. She hopes one day she'll be able to smell the challah she bakes from an old family recipe each Friday.
I braid it, I brush it with egg, I sprinkle it with poppy seeds, I shove it into the oven, and then I set the timer to know when it's ready. The fact that I can't smell it baking, that's something I miss the most.
And we checked in with Andy Hockman, and it turns out about a year after this story aired originally, she went back to her ear, nose, and throat doctor to see if they could try one more time to restore her sense of smell. Several previous attempts using steroids had failed, but this time,
once again, a 10-day course of steroids, followed by a nightly nasal rinse containing a little packet of saline and pH-adjusted powder, and then a little liquid ampoule of an asthma medicine called budesonide that I squirt into the nasal rinse, squirt it up one nostril, it drips down the other, do the same thing in reverse. It's a little revolting, but I got used to it, and it has succeeded.
Hockman uses the drops every night, and voila, she can smell
everything. Yesterday, I was trying a new recipe out of beautiful new cookbook called Jerusalem. The first step of this fairly complicated recipe involved making your own pickled lemons. I had to slice lemons very thin and then macerate them in a bowl with red chili pepper and cumin, coriander, lemon juice, olive oil, and paprika. The instruction was to put a cover on the bowl and set it aside for a couple of hours. And I kept coming into the kitchen and lifting the cover off the bowl just to smell it, just because I could.
Andy Hockman isn't sure why she lost her sense of smell in the first place. Sometimes it's serious sinus troubles. For some people, the loss is caused by head trauma or a bad case of the flu. Medicine can help sometimes, but now scientists are working to fix more stubborn cases by duplicating the body's ability to build and repair nasal tissue. Tanya English reports.
It's a coin flip, really. In about 50% of cases, the sense of smell never comes back. And that loss is often underrated when it comes to health and well-being.
Well, smell is maybe the most primitive of senses. And it's the major source of information for most species on the planet.
Gary Beecham directs Philadelphia's Monell Chemical Senses Center.
We study smell and taste.
Humans are constantly sniffing out danger, spoiled food in the refrigerator, a gas leak, even our own body odor. Still, Beecham says, smell is the sense we take for granted. It's part of an early warning system that inextricably links smell and taste. To demonstrate, Beecham pours out a cup of jelly beans. For this experiment, the gourmet kind are best.
Coffee.
Licorice, watermelon.
And here we've got banana.
Without looking, he chooses two candies.
Basically, what we do is we take two jelly beans that are two different flavors, then put them in your hand and randomly move them around so you don't know which is which. You hold your nose very tightly. So then take one of the jelly beans, put it in your mouth, chew it up.
Then Beecham takes a guess.
The only thing I get in terms of flavor is sweet. So then all I have to do is let go of my nose and boom, there it is.
Licorice. On its own, the tongue perceives salty or bitter or sour, but without smell, the subtleties of anise or fennel are missing. When people go to the doctor complaining about smell loss, though, they don't get much sympathy.
Their primary physician often has no idea what to say or what to do. They consider it sort of like losing a toenail or something like that.
Anosmia is the medical term for an inability to perceive odor. But when the nose is working properly, neurons are nerve cells in the nasal tissue grab odor molecules from the air, then transmit that signal.
And then the brain registers, oh, this is the wonderful smell of lilacs.
Edmund Perbitkin is an ear, nose, and throat specialist at Jefferson University Hospital. To explain what can go wrong, Perbitkin says imagine yourself with a respiratory infection. When you're sniffling and congested, it means a cold virus has taken up residence in the lining of your nose.
Well, those neurons are connected up to the brain. And your body says, I've got this horrible virus. I better just cut this bridge.
Better to sacrifice the sense of smell than to risk brain inflammation that can lead to encephalitis or meningitis.
It's a defense mechanism. It lets the neuron die.
Nerve cells in the nose can recover, but in many cases, they don't. Researchers at Jefferson and Monell are looking for a new way to treat smell loss. Their big idea is to take special cells from the inside of the nose, they're called stem cells, and then use them to cure smell disorders. Stem cells are special because they have the potential to become other cell types. Perbitkin, who's a gardener, explains it this way. In the plant world, if you plant basil, you get basil. But
the amazing thing about these types of cells is, you know what? We can take this seed and maybe we can decide after we've planted it, or depending upon where we've planted it, whether it grows into tomato or basil.
The scientists want to engineer stem cells in the lab to become functioning nerve cells that control smell. The first step is a quick office procedure to collect nasal tissue from healthy volunteers.
And with a very, very small forceps, about the size of a pencil tip, we can basically take the cells that we need to do research.
Next, that nasal tissue gets shipped across town to Monell. There, researcher Mrijala Vinjamuri is currently working with cells from mice, but she starts work on human cells in just a few weeks. Benjamuri turns a few knobs to focus her microscope, then peers down to check the next batch of harvested tissue.
You should be able to see small dots everywhere, and those are your different cells.
The sample includes some neurons, probably a few stem cells, and lots of cells that give nasal tissue its structure. But it's not clear which cells are which. That's the work ahead, to isolate stem cells and then nudge them to become odor-detecting neurons.
Can we transplant them back into humans who have this issue? And can these stem cells still function properly?
That goal is complex enough and years away. But Benjamuri says there's an even bigger obstacle ahead. Neurons in the nose are coded for, only lit up by certain smells.
Each neuron can sort of detect a specific odor. For instance, if you have an odor for like strawberries or something, or banana, for instance, only a certain subset of neurons can smell that.
Getting a nose to detect an odor, that's just one step. Success is making sure the lab-engineered replacement cells send the right signal back to the brain. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Since we first reported this story, Monell scientists say they have made progress in this research. They can now take the nasal stem cells from the noses of healthy people and make them develop into functioning olfactory receptor cells. Hey, we're out of time and we haven't even gotten to sight yet. But do not worry, we've done some great stories on vision and also on people living with deteriorating vision.
So I became aware when I was a little kid that I was seeing these dots everywhere. And I felt like I had some sort of superpower, like I could see atoms.
That's Morgan Fitzpatrick Andrews. He's a performer and a puppeteer. He has a rare congenital eye disease called Cone-Rod Dystrophy 5. He's written a one-man show about it. It's called Cones, and he's taking that show on tour at universities this spring. You can listen to his story on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Libby Tracy is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager is the associate producer. Joel Patterson, the managing editor. And Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Right now, we're working on a story about the things you have to learn when you become a family caregiver, and we would love to hear your stories. Here's David Bobo. His grandmother has dementia. He's been caring for her since he was a teenager.
We make sure she gets her medicine every morning. We crush it up, put it in her applesauce or in her oatmeal, and we have to sweeten it to make sure it's good for her, because she'll spit it out on you if she don't like it.
We want to hear your stories of caregiving as well. You can use the voice memo function on your smartphone to record those stories, perhaps about helping your partner use the bathroom or managing your mother's medications, whatever it is you're doing as a caregiver. We want to hear about it. Send those stories to thepulse@whyy.org. Or if you have any questions about how to do this, just send us an email and we'll walk you through it. And don't miss that edition of The Pulse. Just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.